Well, the countdown is on as President Trump made an appearance on CNBC today, which is the stock market news channel, by the way, appropriate, basically declaring that bombs are ready to fall again. So we are watching as the ceasefire, whatever sort of ceasefire was there in the first place, is falling apart. And the next stage of this looks about to unfold.
Oh, we're going to continue to talk about global energy shocks as it is. We are bracing for it economically. So hopefully you are, too. We've been talking about this for a long time. We're also going to talk about these energy refineries being destroyed at a time when the global economy is at risk because of war. And we're also going to talk about the most moral army because IDF soldiers are reporting moral injury. Do you know what that is? Moral injury. Have you ever heard of this?
When you smash a Jesus statue with a hammer?
Well, I guess that could cause moral injury. What else, Philip? No. Okay. Whereas, so you may or may not know this, but PTSD was developed. It was created to explain the trauma experienced by American Vietnam vets and the constantly reliving of these horrors. Whereas moral injury is something that is basically shame for what you have done yourself, what you've done to other people against your own morals.
All right.
You've done something horrible. Killed a child, for instance, and now you can't live with yourself. Your morals have been injured.
Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about
that. We are going to talk about that. Right. Yeah. A lot to say about that. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that, what you think about it.
All right. Well, we have a very busy show because Professor John Mearsheimer is going to be joining us here in moments to talk about the all of these oil refineries being destroyed, energy shocks, and war crimes by this administration, and what is happening with Iran. We're going to get there in a second. But first,
we want to tell you about our friends at Angel Studio because they have a new show out called The Death of Recess. It's a documentary that you really are going to want to see. It is about how the modern classroom didn't just evolve over time. It was built this way, centralized, standardized, shaped by powerful people in powerful institutions. Angel is hosting Death of Recess because it exposes the truth behind who is funding and shaping our education system, including the curriculum, which helps shape your kids' worldview. At the same time, look at what's disappearing. Recess, movement, unstructured time. These are the things that used to define childhood, and parents being pushed further and further to the sidelines. This isn't really about recess. It is about shaping the next generation. That's why platforms like Angel matters, because they're the only platform brave enough to distribute a documentary like this. They ask the questions most outlets won't touch. So if you're a parent or someone who is paying attention, you should watch this. Go to angel.com/redacted. Join the Angel Guild. Watch The Death of Recess today. Again, that's angel.com/redacted. And if you watch, let us know what you think. It's called The Death of Recess.
Well, President Trump told CNBC, yes, the stock market news channel this morning, that he's ready to go back to war against Iran. Bombs will fall, he told Joe Kernan. Watch.
A lot less lethal a long time ago.
So to be clear, you're saying that you need at least the prospects for a signed deal today and tomorrow, or else you would resume bombing Iran.
Well, I expect to be bombing because I think that's a better attitude to go in with. But you know, we're ready to go. I mean, the military is raring to go. They are absolutely incredible. You know, I built the military in my first term. I'm using it now. The military, when I took it over from Barack Hussein Obama, they had just, it was so depleted, so sad. And I built it in my first term. You remember those big numbers. You talked to me about it once. That's a lot of money for military. I built it. We did a great job with our military. And we're using it now and rebuilding it, too. We've done a lot of rebuilding also in my first year of the second term. But we have a tremendous rhythm.
So that's great. So I built this thing that we have to use it. We have to use it to bomb other countries. That's what we have got to do, is just build it. We got to use it to bomb other countries.
If you
right
build
now.
It, they will come.
So that's great news that we're going to be using all of these bombs that that he built up. So that's great. J.D. Vance's trip to Islamabad is on hold now. We're learning that as talks appear to be off for now after Iran demanded the U.S. lift the blockade of certain ports. So the Iranians were not even going to show up to this to begin with. And there's so many moving parts right now as this, we're sort of counting down here as the ceasefire looks to be wrapping up and bombs about to fall. So who's holding all the cards here? And who's going to blink first in this? Professor John Mearsheimer is the author of How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy. Of course, also the author of one of the greatest books I've ever read, which is The Israel Lobby. It's a must read, and I think everybody should read this book if they want to understand how Washington is completely sold out to the Israel lobby. And the professor is joining us for the very first time here on Redacted. Finally, a pleasure. We've been trying to think get you on for about a year and a half, but every time we reach out, you're in an airport. So great to have you here, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's our great pleasure. So who do you think blinks first? It seems like we are winding down with a few hours left here. We're at this brinksmanship moment here. Does Iran blink? Does the United States blink? And who do you think holds all the cards?
Well, I think it's not in America's interest to go back to war. I think we have a deep-seated interest in negotiating a settlement here. And the reason is, if we go up the escalation ladder, which is effectively what going back to war would mean, the Iranians hold the cards, not the Americans. President Trump can talk about how powerful the American military is and all the wonderful things that he thinks it can do. But nobody can tell a plausible story about how escalating this war, whether with ground forces, naval forces, or air forces, produces a favorable outcome for us. So I think we have a deep-seated interest in negotiating some sort of settlement. And for that reason, I would be surprised if President Trump doesn't work out some sort of arrangement to keep the ceasefire in place and facilitate negotiations in Islamabad. I would actually be surprised if he attacks Iran. I wouldn't be completely surprised, because who knows for sure exactly what's going on in his mind and in the back channels as well. But my sense is that we're not going to go back to war.
And so what we're seeing is rhetoric that continues to repeat. And that's why you see the memes now about Groundhog Day. And so, you know, can the president spin it in a way that gets him out of bombing? Or will it just be what seemed to be the initial strategy, which is inflict suffering on the Iranian people through attacking their infrastructure so that they demand Iran bend the knee?
I think he can spin it for two reasons. One is the public is overwhelmingly against this war. I don't think the public wants to see the war start up again or the shooting start up again. But the second thing is that the markets look good when President Trump is talking peace. And when it looks like war is about to start up again, the price of oil shoots up and the stock market goes down. So I think it would be reasonably easy for him to spin this in a positive way, even if we would conclude, if we looked at it carefully, that it was him backing off, not the Iranians.
I mean, this morning you had, before you jumped on, I played the soundbite from Trump on with Joe Kernan this morning on CNBC, on a which is a stock market news channel. It would have only been one stage worse if he went to Bloomberg TV and did this announcement that he expects more bombs to fall on Iran. And as soon as he made that announcement, the price of Brent crude oil skyrocketed once again on that announcement. So why do you think he chose, like, going on a business news show in the morning to make this proclamation?
I'm actually surprised that he did. I do think that he believes that talking tough will coerce the Iranians into coming back to the negotiating table, number one, and number two, making concessions once they get to the negotiating table. He thinks he has a lot of leverage. He thinks that this military instrument that he has is a big stick that will produce a lot of successful results if he wields it in an effective way. And I think he's wrong in that regard. And the mere fact that every time he talks about going back to war, oil prices rise and the stock market falls tells you that those two institutions understand full well that going back to war doesn't make sense.
A lot of White House insiders, Tucker Carlson among one of them, has said the president didn't really want to do this war. He acted when he says he acted in person like he didn't want to do it, but he had to do it anyway. So what do you think are the forces pushing him to continue to say this? Do you think it really is about a nuclear weapon, or is there something else?
Well, I think that the New York Times has written two big articles on the decision-making process, and the second of those two articles in late March, which was based on extensive interviews, pretty much lays out the story. And it's quite clear that President Trump was convinced by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of Mossad, a man named David Barnea, that if he used military force in conjunction with the Israelis, in a shock and awe campaign where we decapitated the regime, this would lead to the almost instant collapse of the Iranian regime. There would be a popular uprising from below, and the end result is that some kind of regime would come into place that would dance to our tune. President Trump really believed, I think, that we had a war-winning formula. We could win a quick and decisive victory. What's amazing to me about the whole process is that almost all of his advisors told him that this was not a good idea. And some of them told the president, including the head of the CIA, that they were fundamentally opposed. And General Kane, who is his hand-picked chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told him that we had no war-winning strategy. Nevertheless, President Trump went ahead, and he went ahead in large part because the Israelis bamboozled him into thinking that he could win a quick and decisive victory.
I know. I keep reflecting on your book, The Israel Lobby. It seems like you have these advisors that have surrounded the president and in large part have been telling him this is a nightmare. So what voices do you believe he's listening to that he believed that it was going to be a quick march in, they would kill the Ayatollah, and this thing would wrap up in 4 days?
Well, he listened to the Israelis. He listened to the head of Mossad. If you read the Israeli press, there are all sorts of stories that say that David Barnea, the head of Mossad, basically lived in the White House, that he spent so much time in Washington trying to convince President Trump that a shock and awe strategy would finish off the regime and lead to a new regime that was attuned to our interests. And of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu, for him, attacking Iran is his Moby Dick. It's been an obsession with him for about 40 years, and he's been beating President Trump over the head for ages now to go in and finish Iran off. And I think they were able, those two, and a lot of Trump's advisors as well, who are closely tied to Israel, like Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, surely helped in the process to convince President Trump that we had a war-winning strategy. And of course, we didn't. People like J.D. Vance and John Ratcliffe, the head of the CIA, were correct.
Now, what happens, though, since you've studied the Israel lobby so acutely? They got their way. They got the war they wanted. It is not playing out well for Israel on the world stage. So in your, I guess, estimate, what will they do next if they've lost global public opinion and they've lost this war? It seems like that despair could be equally dangerous.
Well, I think in terms of global public opinion, that doesn't really matter to the Israelis. I think if you look at their behavior during the genocide, it's quite clear that they don't care what the global public thinks. I think what's much more important is where we are in this war against Iran. What President Trump is trying to do is to shut down this war. He wants a settlement. And the reason that he wants a settlement and he's willing to make compromises with the Iranians is because he understands that there is a real danger that the global economy will go off a cliff. And President Trump, therefore, has a deep-seated interest, to put it mildly, in ending this war as soon as possible. But the Israelis do not want him to end the war because the Israelis understand full well that we have failed to achieve our objectives in this war. It's really quite remarkable when you look at what's happened over the past 50 plus days. The United States and Israel started off with four clear goals. One was regime change. Two was to do away with Iranian missiles. Three was to get Iran to stop supporting Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Hamas. And then four was to eliminate Iran's nuclear enrichment capability once and for all. We've achieved none of those goals. And indeed, we've created a situation where Iran now controls the Strait of Hormuz, which it did not control the day before the war. That would be February 27th. Huh. So we have effectively lost this war. And what the Israelis want us to do is not quit, but to restart the war and try to achieve those goals.
When you look at the Strait of Hormuz, because you brought it up, there's a lot that you said there I want to unpack over the next few questions here. But the Strait of Hormuz blockade, you've said, is not only ineffective, it's counterproductive. The United States basically admitting, or President Trump, that we'll have sort of a permanent presence there. How does that help the United States at all?
Well, what happened here is we tried to get a ceasefire. And two of the key elements in that ceasefire were, number one, the Israelis would stop bombing Lebanon, and number two, the Iranians would then open the Strait of Hormuz. And this past Friday, we had a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in place, and the Iranians indicated that they were going to open the Strait of Hormuz. So it looked like all the elements of the ceasefire were in place, and that would facilitate the discussions that were supposed to take place today and tomorrow in Islamabad. But what happened is that President Trump, and I do not understand why, said that he was going to keep the U.S. naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz in place,
right,
which in effect is saying that he's going to keep the blockade on Iran in place. Unsurprisingly, the Iranians turned around and said, we're reclosing the strait. Right. And that helped. And if you look at why we're not going to have this meeting today or tomorrow in Islamabad, it's in large part because the Iranians insist that the United States end its blockade of the strait. So President Trump, if anything, has undermined any chance at this juncture of a meaningful negotiation to end this conflict. It's just hard to understand what he was doing. And by the way, I would add that one of the reasons that we did not have a blockade on the strait before last week was we wanted that Iranian oil out in the global oil market to keep oil prices down. We were allowing the Iranians to ship oil through the Strait of Hormuz because we thought it was in our interest to have that Iranian oil out in the market. But once you go to a blockade of the strait, a U.S. blockade of the strait, that oil no longer comes out. And if anything, that just undermines our position from an economic perspective. So all of this behavior by the president just does not make any sense to me at all.
Yes, but a couple weeks ago, we had Professor Mirandi on the show, and he recommended a book called Going to Tehran, by actually their American foreign policy experts, talking about the decades of reneging on détente. Is that how you say that?
Détente.
I only read it with Iran. And this is consistent with what the Clinton administration did to Iran, with what Obama has done to Iran, ignoring them, pulling the rug out from under them. They have made sincere efforts to make negotiations. So this is really a bipartisan, it's an extension of the uniparty. Why have we done this for so long? Are you able to sort of see a puppet behind this nonsensical behavior?
Absolutely. If you read the chapter on Iran, we have a whole chapter on Iran in the book on the Israel lobby. That's Steve Walt and I. And we lay out in great detail how the Iranians moved at different points over the years, especially in the 1990s, to develop some sort of rapprochement with the United States. The Iranians understood that it was not in their interest to have a permanent hostility with the United States. And of course, President Clinton, as you'll see, understood that right off the bat, and he wanted to move towards some form of rapprochement. But what happened is the lobby moved in and told him that was inexcusable. You just couldn't do that. That Iran had to remain the devil incarnate. And that's been the case for a long, long time now. And as I say, you want to remember that for Prime Minister Netanyahu, Iran is his Moby Dick. And that means for the lobby, Iran is Moby Dick. And the lobby and Israel work hand in hand to make sure we have hostile relations with Iran, even though Iran is not a threat to the United States. It's very important to understand that. The idea that Iran is a threat to us makes no sense at all. It just isn't.
I saw Piers Morgan getting into it with you the other day because he's arguing that they fund Hezbollah. Your argument, of course, is that, well, that has nothing to do with us. That has a direct connection to Israel. And why are we involved in it to begin with?
Well, also, may I point out that Hezbollah originally wanted a relationship with the United States, and George Bush said no. And they did not, in fact, want to align themselves with Iran. That was plan B for Hezbollah.
So I guess Professor Netanyahu now has, it seems like he's given up trying to take on Hezbollah head on. They tried it against, it seems like they keep trying this and it keeps failing. And now is trying to really create like a civil war inside of Lebanon. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Israelis went into Lebanon in 1982 and then they left in 2000 with their tail between their legs. They had a devil of a time occupying Lebanon, which is why they left. Then they went back in 2006. And it was a quick and decisive defeat for the Israelis, and they pulled out of Lebanon. And here we are with the Israelis back in southern Lebanon and having a devil of a time dealing with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And furthermore, they continue to bomb Lebanon, but they can bomb Lebanon forever and ever, just as they bombed Iran in the recent war and in the war last June. But do they produce a victory as a result of all that? No. Is Hezbollah defeated? No. Is Hamas defeated? No. Are the Houthis defeated? No. Is Iran defeated? No. The Israelis believe, like many Americans do, that you can use military force to solve what are essentially political problems. And sometimes you can do that, but not often. And there's no way that the Israelis can deal with the Hezbollah problem or the Hamas problem without a political solution. But they refuse to develop some sort of policy, some sort of political solution for dealing with these groups. And instead, they think they can just pound them into the ground. But it just hasn't worked very well. And in my opinion, it's not going to work well.
I was going to say, stay right there. We have a bunch of more questions for you. We're going to take a quick break, grab some water. We want to ask you about war crimes, particularly U.S. Ambassador Mike Walls announcing on Meet the Press this weekend that, you know, bombing infrastructure, you know, civilian infrastructure, bombing roads, bridges, hospitals, and otherwise is essentially part of the game, seems to be fair game now in this war. I want to talk about that. Plus, all of these refineries that have been going up in smoke. Get your sense of the global oil shock and what's in store for the broader global economy. So if you will, Professor, just we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with you in just a moment if you're kind enough to stick around.
Sure.
All right. We want to tell you about our friends over at Better Wild because we love our puppies, right? We love our dogs. And, you know, if you have a dog that suddenly just starts like itching and scratching, and that's an allergy. That's not good. And so that's where our friends at Better Wild comes in, because you can actually find out that dog allergies in dogs often start in the gut. And when things get out of balance, internally it can show up everywhere in issues with their skin, their ears, their digestion. And now that it's getting warm outside and the doggies are outside a lot more, you want to pay attention to this. That's where our friends at Better Wild came up with their allergy relief soft chews. They're designed to support your pet's allergy defenses by strengthening digestion and helping restore balance from the inside. They're the first and only chews with ancestral advantage wolf probiotics and natural ingredients. So instead of just covering things up, they're actually supporting your dog at the source. So Better Wild is committed to helping your dog's clinically proven, veterinary approved solutions. Check them out today. Go to Better Wild is offering our listeners 40% off your order. Go to betterwild.com/redacted. That's betterwild.com/redacted for up to 40% off, 40% off.
All right, breaking news. The White House just published this statement by President Trump saying, based on the fact that the government of Iran is seriously fractured and upon the request of Iranian authorities, we have been asked to hold our attack on the country until such time as their leaders and representatives come up with a unified proposal. And so I have just directed our military to continue the blockade. But otherwise, we're going to hold off on this whole let's bomb them to So Professor Mearsheimer joins us today. And what do you make of this pivot where he said on the news, we're going back in, can't, you know, they didn't show up. And now he's saying they came to me. They're in shambles. They need some time to get their ducks in order. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what President Trump just said is consistent with the point I made early in the program. I think despite all his bluster, he is not interested in going back to war against Iran. And I think if you listen to what you just read, I think it's an artful explanation for why he backed off. He's putting the source of the problem on the Iranians. He's saying the problem here is that they can't figure out what they're doing, because the left hand and the right hand are not working together. And he, being the generous leader that he is going to give them time to work out a position. And then they can go from there, and hopefully they'll be able to negotiate an end to the war. So he is, you know, in a very crafty way, getting himself out of the mess that he got himself into with all his bluster.
So I've often asked the question, but what is the off ramp for President Trump in this situation? Are we seeing now maybe the pieces of the off ramp starting to be built here?
It's hard to say exactly what the off ramp is, because there are probably about 7 or 8 big issues that have to be solved. A lot of the focus is on the nuclear enrichment issue. First of all, we don't even know what the deal is regarding nuclear enrichment, but there are a whole slew of other issues that have to be dealt with, like the question of who controls the strait, what's the future of U.S. military bases in the region, what sort of security architecture are you going to put in place to convince the Iranians that they're not going to be attacked again, what are you going to do with reparations, what are you going to do with sanctions. I could go on and on. There are just a lot of big issues. Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, and Iran's relations with them. So all these elements have to be worked out to get some sort of meaningful agreement.
Well, so also, it's weird because the president today on CNBC specifically said that using force is his greatest sort of cudgel in this, you know, to use bombs, use the threat of bombs. That's how he can get them to come up with a unified proposal. That's how he can get them to come to the table. And now he's basically admitting that, well, they're too fractured. We're just going to step back and allow them to come up with something on their own. I don't understand.
It's so funny when you put it that way, because who buys that? Like, oh, yes, grand and merciful.
Well, we get them to negotiate through killing them. That's how it works.
But you want to, this is not to disagree with you for one second, but just to reinforce your point. You want to remember that we started this war and we bombed them heavily for a long, long time. And we did not succeed. If you look at where we are today, we have not achieved any of our goals. And for me, that means so far we have lost the war. And President Trump seems to believe that even though we've lost the war by bombing them up to now, he can now restart the bombing. And for some reason, it's going to do all these wonderful things that it was unable to do from the start of the war up until the recent ceasefire. And of course, this is a foolish argument. We have no military option here. It's just very important to understand that. And actually, if we begin to escalate, I believe that plays into the hands of the Iranians. I have long argued that if I were playing the Iranians' hand, I would not have gone to Islamabad. I would not be talking about going to Islamabad in the next couple of days. I'd say to the United States, go ahead. Up the ante, go up the escalation ladder, and let's see what happens to the international economy. And as the international economy which I liken to the Titanic heading towards an iceberg, gets closer and closer to that iceberg, I think Iran's leverage will grow by leaps and bounds, and they'll be able to get an even better deal than they would get now. But the fact is, President Trump is not playing the strong hand here. He is playing a remarkably weak hand here. And the problem he faces, again, is that the Israelis don't want him to end the war. The Israelis understand that we have lost, that we have not achieved their goals, and they want him to continue, President Trump, that is, they want him to continue pounding Iran to escalate. But Trump knows that that is not a war-winning formula.
Here's this meme that this is J.D. Vance. This has kind of gone viral. This is from the Iranian embassy in Indonesia, put out this meme of President or Vice President Vance just standing there waiting.
It's a Mr. Bean meme.
Yeah, Mr. Bean meme.
And so they did exactly what you said, not last week, but this week. They no-showed. They didn't show up.
Yeah, they weren't going to. And so to save face, they basically said, well, we're not going to send J.D. Vance. We're going to put a pause on that. Otherwise, he'd be sitting in an empty room.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, as we were talking about before, the problem here is the U.S. blockade on the Strait of Hormuz, which is effectively a blockade on Iran. The Iranians are insisting that we take that blockade off. And my guess would be that President Trump will work out some sort of arrangement over the next couple days so that the blockade is taken off, the U.S. blockade is taken off, so both sides can come to Islamabad and begin to negotiate. But you want to remember, as I was saying before, there are a whole slew of issues that have to be settled here before you can shut down this war. It's not like there's just one issue, which is nuclear enrichment. And even in the case of nuclear enrichment, that is a really tricky issue. So I think it's going to take something of a miracle to get any kind of meaningful agreement, especially when you consider that the Israelis and the lobby here in the United States will be doing everything it can or everything they can to undermine any agreement that President Trump tries to come up with.
Well, let's talk about the economy. You brought it up, and I want to talk about the oil shocks. And we had Professor Pape on the show yesterday, who's made the argument that things have accelerated now for this, you know, global catastrophe in a way that maybe we didn't anticipate before. But and now we're also going to see, of course, the fertilizer troubles, the food shortages and potential famine problems. Here's just a few minutes ago, oil prices once again go back down. They went up, they skyrocketed this morning, and then they plummeted after the president just announced this extension of the U.S. ceasefire. But let's just talk about the global economy right now and where you see things playing out, both for the United States and, frankly, for Europe, which seems to be on the edge of disaster.
Well, just to talk about the Gulf itself, about 20 million barrels a day normally came out of the Gulf, and the world economy needs about 100 million barrels a day. That's where the 20% figure comes from. We make the argument that 20% of the world's oil comes through the Gulf. So that's 20 million barrels out of 100 million barrels. I would estimate that somewhere on the order of 9 to 10 million barrels are now getting out, which means that somewhere between 10 and 11 million barrels are bottled up there. And furthermore, there's quite a bit of oil, Saudi oil, coming out of the Red Sea. And the Red Sea is on the other side of Saudi Arabia from the Persian Gulf. So if we ramp up the war, right, if President Trump goes hard after Iran, what's going to happen here is that the amount of oil that comes out of the Gulf will be close to zero. And furthermore, the Houthis and Iran are almost certain to shut down the Red Sea. And given all the damage that's been done to the international economy so far, if you take into account what would happen if the Gulf is completely shut down and the Red Sea is shut down, you're talking about the Titanic eventually hitting the iceberg. Wow. This, again, is why Trump can just not go up the escalation ladder. When you talk about what Bob Pape was saying, Bob was talking about the situation today in light of the fact that some oil is still coming out of the Gulf, and a lot of oil is coming out of the Red Sea. That's where the Saudi oil is coming out. So the situation is not as dire as it would be if we shut down the Gulf completely. So that's the oil and gas story. With regard to fertilizers, roughly one-third of the world's fertilizers come out of the Gulf. And the fact that fertilizers are so important for providing food for people all around the world, especially in rather poor countries, shutting off the flow of fertilizers out of the Gulf is going to have disastrous consequences. Huge numbers of people are going to starve to death. Furthermore, it's quite clear that helium is not coming out of the Gulf that is absolutely essential for developing microchips. Aluminum, the Gulf is a big provider of aluminum. That's been cut off, the flow of aluminum out of the Gulf. Furthermore, jet fuel and diesel fuel has been cut off in serious ways. And there's talk that that in Europe, they only have about 6 weeks left of jet fuel for their airplanes. So the consequences are already quite stark. And as you move forward, it's just going to get worse and worse. And that's assuming that we don't attack Iran. You want to remember the argument that a lot of people are making today is that President Trump just has to solve the problem right away. In fact, he should have solved the problem yesterday, just so we can begin to repair all the damage that has been done. Well, if that doesn't happen and the status quo remains in place, you're just going to have more and more damage. This is the point that Bob Pape is making. The additional point that I'm making is if you go back to war, the situation gets even worse because the Red Sea will be shut down, the Gulf will be almost completely shut, and we will really be in deep trouble then economically.
You know, someone in the chat says, the cup is half full with the professor, because you seem to be indicating, yes, this is bluster. He can't really do it. And he knows this. And yet he has escalated in some quite terrible ways, starting, like you said, with, a war bombing a school of young girls. So can we account for the fact that it seems very illogical, but he's done it anyway many times when it always seemed illogical?
Well, there's a difference between starting the war and then escalating. He started the war thinking that he was going to win a quick and decisive victory. This is when that tragic mishap took place where those young girls were killed. But he was under the impression that he could win a quick and decisive victory early on. And then when he didn't win a quick and decisive victory, there's no question he escalated because he thought that increased bombing, more and more bombing, would bring the Iranians to heel. But that didn't happen. And then he moved to a ceasefire. And he has not been that reckless since then. He has not been anxious to go back to bombing. And what he did, in fact, was turn to the Navy. You want to remember that militaries have three instruments they can use to either coerce or defeat an adversary in combat. One is the Army, one is the Air Force, and one is the Navy. And what President Trump started with was the Air Force and naval aircraft, right? That's what he started with, air power. And that didn't work. And there was talk that he would go to a ground invasion, but he's not gone to a ground invasion, and he's not going to go to a ground invasion. He just doesn't have enough combat forces in the region. Plus, he doesn't want boots on the ground. So air power failed, no ground power option. And what did he turn to? He turned to the Navy, and he turned to this blockade. That's the real coercive leverage he believes he now has on the Iranians. It's the blockade. But the blockade is of limited utility. And that's why he's talking about going back to bombing. He's not saying I can keep the blockade on and the blockade is a war-winning weapon, because it's not. And there are all sorts of complications associated with the blockade we haven't talked about that illustrate this. But the point is, he's now talking about going back to bombing, which he hasn't done for a few weeks now. And the reason he hasn't done it for a few weeks now is it doesn't work. And the reason I don't think he'll go back to that is because it won't work. It'll just make a bad situation even worse. He has no military solution here. He can't bring the Iranians to accept his demands with military force. And that's why he has to negotiate. And in fact, he's playing a losing hand. So he's going to have to make some major concessions to the Iranians. And again, as I keep emphasizing, the problem he faces, the reason he's in so much trouble, is Israel and its minions in the United States will go to enormous lengths not to let him make a deal with the Iranians.
Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth, because I'm thinking, as you're making all these great points, there's one huge variable sitting at the table, and that is the Israelis. And we heard from the head of Mossad just a week or so ago saying we will not end this war until we have full regime change in that country. And then, of course, the courting of President Trump through Mossad and making sure that they are carrying out their plans. So what about the Israeli variable in all of this? Will they allow President Trump to not stop bombing?
Well, look, they will go to great lengths to do that. And I think the fact is that President Trump is likely to reach a point where he feels he has no choice but to play hardball with the Israelis in ways that no U.S. president has ever done that. And the reason is that if he doesn't play hardball with the Israelis and tell them that he's going to take a deal with Iran and they just have to swallow that fact, then the international economy at some point is going to go off a cliff. This just can't go on and on and on. Something has to be done to shut this war down. That means the Israelis cannot get what they want. Again, what the Israelis want here, as was clear from your comment regarding what the head of Mossad said, is they want regime change. Well, good luck. If anything, this bombing campaign has reinforced the regime's position inside of Iran. And it's caused a rally around the flag effect. So regime change is much harder now than it was on February 27th. How are we going to get regime change? We're going to unleash the dogs and tear Iran apart? We're going to wreck it as a civilization? I don't think so.
A few weeks ago or a week ago, I think you said that President Trump's only solution here is surrender. Do you think that that's still the case?
I think that he basically has to concede defeat, and he's going to have to accept most of Iran's demands. I think that he will be able to get the Iranians to make certain concessions, because the Iranians will conclude that if they get enough concessions from the United States, it makes sense to not prolong the war and cut a deal. But what exactly those concessions look like is hard to say. If you ask me to describe what a likely deal looks like, how you deal with all the different elements that are on the table, I couldn't really do that. I don't know, you know, what Trump is willing to give away and what he considers important. I think the big issue for Trump, and I think for the Israelis, is the nuclear enrichment issue. I think if Trump can get a deal on nuclear enrichment that looks like a great improvement over the JCPOA. The JCPOA, of course, was the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. If Trump can get a much better version of the JCPOA, he may be willing to concede on a number of other points, such as the fact that Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz moving forward, and it can put a toll booth in place, and it can use the money from that toll booth to take care of reparations. I mean, something along those lines. And then Trump will have to concede on all sorts of issues like the missiles, support for the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah, and so forth and so on. But there's no way we're going to come out of this looking like we won. Right. We'll get a concession or two, I believe. And I think we'll get a concession or two on the nuclear enrichment issue. But we won't win. We will not win, in my opinion, a complete victory on the nuclear enrichment issue. The best that I think Trump can do is get get a deal that says where he can say it's better than the JCPOA. But we've lost this war. We started a losing war.
Yeah.
Wow.
Philip has a question.
Yeah, Philip on our team has Go ahead, Philip.
So my big thing, like, and I think like one of the other factors that's not really come up very often is like, at what point does the rest of the world decide that this is an act of war against them? Like, how long are people going to sit there and let the U.S. destroy the global economy? Like, there are other countries out there. It amazes me that they're allowing it to happen. Like, yes. At what point does everybody else step in and say, all right, you're done?
Well, you're absolutely right. The rest of the world is shaking in their boots. There's just no question about that. This is why I believe the Chinese and the Russians put pressure on the Iranians to go to Istanbul. It's why the Chinese have been working with the Pakistanis. They're both close allies. They've been working together to facilitate negotiations. The Chinese and the Russians and every other country on the planet understands that if we hit the iceberg, we're all finished. It would be a total disaster. It'd be like the Great Depression, worse than the Great Depression in the late 1920s, 1930s. You can rest assured that there is a tremendous amount of pressure being put on President Trump by other countries to shut this war down. I have no doubt about that. But the problem you want to keep in mind is that the United States is an incredibly powerful country, and it's pretty much free to do whatever it wants. And President Trump is the kind of leader who doesn't care that much about what other countries say. As I like to point out, he is a supreme unilateralist. He is not someone who's interested in multilateralism or working with allies or working with institutions. He does what Donald Trump thinks is the right thing to do. And that makes it difficult for foreign leaders to convince him to alter his behavior. Because, again, he's so powerful and he is so inclined to act unilaterally and not really take into account the interests of others. But I think it's become clear to him, and I think it's become clear to all his advisors, that we run the serious risk of tanking the international economy. You'd have to be blind not to understand that threat is out there. And I think that threat is what will get him to cut a deal at some point. And again, the problem he'll face is Israel and the lobby.
And I think you'd also be blind not to see all of these oil refineries around the world that are going up in flames. It seems like many of these oil refineries are BRICS-aligned oil refinery countries, whether in India, Russia, and other places, although we've seen some of these oil refineries going up in flames in Texas and other places. But I just don't believe in coincidences, Professor. And you see, I mean, I think we're over 10 of them now, maybe even like 12 of them now, up in flames. What do you make of all of these oil refineries, one of which was about to be inaugurated by Modi in India, like celebrating the launch of this brand, and then it blows up the day before?
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't heard this story. Tell me more about it.
Well, that's really all we know. It's just that you have oil refineries in Pakistan. One just went up in flames today in Pakistan. You had yesterday in India going up in flames right before Modi was about to inaugurate it. You have this Russian one that's up in flames. You have, I think, in Romania. I mean, the list is growing by the day. And it seems to me intentional. When you take out the infrastructure of many of the BRICS-aligned countries, sleeper cells? I don't know. I mean, but my mind, you know, I just don't believe in coincidences, and all of these things are going up in flames within the last 2 weeks. It, you know, makes no sense to me.
Well, the only thing I know about, I mean, I'll have to look into what you're talking about, but the only thing I know about is that the Ukrainians are very interested in attacking Russian oil refineries.
Yeah, which they did in the past 24 hours. So they hit a massive one in Russia. So that's just one of like 12 that have now gone up in flames in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, the Ukrainians are very upset with the fact that President Trump has taken sanctions off of Russian oil, because President Trump wants Russian oil, just like he heretofore has wanted Iranian oil out in the global market to keep the price of oil down. So the Russians are selling lots of oil these days and making out like a bandit. And the Ukrainians, needless to say, are very upset about this. And what they want to do is attack Russian oil facilities. and do that with drones. And they have been somewhat successful in that regard. But I hadn't heard about all the other refineries that are blowing up.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just don't believe in coincidences. Oh, and it's very fascinating what's happening suddenly with all of that. But, Professor, it's been a real pleasure to have you here on the show. We hope you'll come back. We hope we were welcoming enough. Hopefully our accommodations here at Hotel Redacted were okay for you.
The snacks in the green room are really good.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor. Great to have you here.
You're more than welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much, Professor. Really appreciate it. All right.
Well, that was very exciting.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I just was on every word. And I think, you know, it's one of those interviews where you want to like rewind it and go back and re-listen to it, you know, two and three times. I think his point, I mean, well, many, many great points. But to his point on President Trump, like there is really no off ramp here, that we lost this war the moment we started this war.
Right. And so the White House spin right now is just so interesting. Is like,
well, that's one thing I was going to ask.
Iran's
him.
A mess. Yeah. We're going to let them pull their pants up and then we'll get back to it later. We were going to bomb the shit out of them. Now we've decided not to. Like, it's very, it's hysterical.
Well, that was one of the questions I forgot. I want to let the professor go and be respectful of his time. But that's one of the things I wanted to ask him. Is like, how will the White House spin this yarn? Because we clearly have lost. So how will they try to spin this yarn? Mm-hmm. And you'll get people like Cat Turd and these other people online, like the Laura Loomers of the world, to spin a yarn about how we won.
Right.
Like, what will that propaganda look like?
And then also, you know, you start to see people saying, oh, the panicans were wrong. See, we were never going to do this. We never meant it. Well, you could see it that way, as it was a bluff, or you can see it as a defeat. You know, I guess it's based on your partisan lens.
Yeah, I don't exactly know like in what world you would think this is a success.
In the words of my grandmother during the Iraq, when we were in Iraq for way too long, she's like, why don't they just declare victory and bring everybody home? That's all you got to do. You don't have to win, just declare victory and bring everybody home. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, have George Bush land on an aircraft carrier and say, mission accomplished.
Right.
And you know what? They'll believe it. Great. If you believe that, great. Then get these men and women home so they don't have to die.
Sure. No backsies. You won. It's over now. Go home.
Great. You're no threat to us. There's no threat to us at all. And I don't know if you saw his back and forth with Piers Morgan the other night, because Piers is like, well, they fund Hezbollah and they're, well, that's not a threat to us. That's a threat to, I guess, if anything, it's a threat to Israel, which I don't give a shit about.
Like, you shouldn't have invaded Lebanon. Hezbollah wouldn't have been created.
So here's what happens.
Stay in your own, eyes on your own paper, and then you don't have terrorists.
Here's what happens. When you invade another country, you expect then to have blowback from that.
Yeah.
Like, you invade southern Lebanon, you expect then to Hezbollah to be furious that you're
right.
doing
Are
that.
You new here? You go here? Like, when you invade places, they create resistance. So
that's how this works.
Yeah, we're not new here. This is our school. We go here. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about how Israeli media is reporting that the IDF is suffering from moral injury. That is, their soldiers are suffering from the things that they inflicted on innocent civilians. Why we should want to hear about this? Well, because our politicians continue to insist that Israel is the most moral army. They continue to push them on us as model allies. So we're just going to take a little look at that in just a second. But first, we want to tell you about our friends at Cowboy Colostrum, because the spring is here, and if you're finally ready to see real results, a healthier gut, glowing skin, stronger hair, and steady energy, then you should add colostrum to your daily routine, because it all starts in the gut, and once your gut is right, everything else follows. Cowboy Colostrum offers the highest quality bovine, that means cow colostrum, available in the U.S. Cowboy Colostrum is 100% made in America from 100% American grass-fed cows. Now, if you've ever been a nursing mommy, like I have, you know what a colostrum is. It's the first substance that a mammal makes. It's like a pre-milk. It's basically, when you see it as a mom, you're like, great, my kid's getting basically a full multivitamin, it's a prebiotic, it's a probiotic, it's what they need really to thrive. Well, you still can use this substance from bovine sources and still thrive like your little baby did if you've ever given your baby colostrum. So it isn't processed or stripped down, it's whole, full fat, high in protein for ultimate nutrient density. Colostrum, again, is great for gut health, improves overall health. So now you can go to cowboycolostrum.com/redacted news or scan that QR code on your screen. For a limited time, you can get 25% off your entire order. Again, go to cowboycolostrum.com/redacted news, 25% off your order. And this is something that I like to put in my yogurt daily. So it's really easy. The scoop is quite small. The dosage is small. So it's not a major imposition to just add it to your daily routine. You'll be so glad that you did. cowboycolostrum.com/redacted news. Well, the Israeli Defense Force says it will punish the soldiers that were photographed destroying this statue of Jesus Christ by taking a sledgehammer to the head. The image, quite unsurprisingly, prompted outrage online. Now, the IDF responded saying, "We found this person and the people around him, and that this soldier's conduct is wholly inconsistent with the values expected of its troops." Well, Israel supporters like to tell us that Israel has the most moral army in the world. They say, look, yes, they bomb schools and hospitals, but they tell them before they're going to do it. They did not on April 8th when they bombed civilian apartments in Beirut, but most of the time they do, and they minimize civilian deaths. Here is Mike Huckabee recently telling Tucker Carlson that the IDF just doesn't get enough credit for how high their morals are. Watch.
You are not giving Israel credit for having done everything they possibly could to a level that, quite frankly, in urban warfare, there has never been a war that has been
documented. I mean to criticize Israel, but it's a foreign country, and I would much rather criticize a foreign country than my own.
Feel free to do that. They can handle it.
But you pivoted against our country.
No,
by saying Israel's done a better job than our military has.
No, I simply gave you the illustration, and I helped you understand that Israel goes to lengths that no other country, including ours, goes to in the middle of an urban war. And yet Israel ended up with fewer civilian deaths in an urban war than any urban war of record.
You said you didn't know how many civilian deaths there were. So how can you say that?
If you took Gaza's numbers, Hamas's numbers,
you would
still be.
You said you don't know what the numbers are.
Okay, so he says he doesn't believe the death numbers, but he knows that they're far less than what the U.S. perpetrated in Afghanistan, which is not true. It's just unequivocally a lie. It's nonsense. You can't really engage with it, but it is indicative of this propaganda that we must reject the idea that Israel and the U.S., for that matter, both the aggressors in the war with Iran, are the moral army. Now, of course, I can show you examples until the cows come home of the IDF over the last few years, executing medics, double tap bombing raids on hospitals and schools, firing on food lines. Most recently, the horrific attack of April 8th on Beirut. But don't take my word for it. Take the word of former IDF soldiers. This piece came out recently in Haaretz, and it is harrowing reading. It is reporting that the IDF soldiers have an increasing number of what they call moral injuries after what they perpetrated in Gaza. It's not what they witnessed. It's not like PTSD, whereas PTSD is a diagnosis that was created for Vietnam vets who had witnessed atrocities. Moral injury is trauma caused by one's own actions. Now, here is how this professor at the University of Haifa put it. Says, moral injury happens due to exposure to incidents that are perceived as a fundamental violation of basic moral values of oneself or of others, typically involves feelings of guilt, shame, rage, disgust, alienation, loss of faith, breakdown in identity, meaning, and a sense of humanity. So these IDF soldiers told Haaretz specifically about what haunts them. Here is one man telling this story, saying he was out on this Gaza road. He saw some suspicious figures. He says, I was firing like a madman, like they teach you in basic training. So basic IDF training is basically go batshit crazy with your gun. That's what he's implying here. He says, when we got to our destination, I realized these weren't terrorists. It was just an old guy and three boys, maybe teenagers. Not one of them was armed, but their bodies were riddled with bullets, organs pouring out. I'd never seen anything like that up close. He says, I remember the silence. Nobody uttered a word. Then the battalion commander came over with his people and one spat on the bodies and yelled, this is what happens to anyone who messes with Israel, you sons of bitches. I was in shock and I kept quiet, I guess just because I'm a gutless loser, a gutless coward. So this story is just chock full, this article, with stories like this from the IDF soldiers' own mouth. One is a guy who said, you know, we just planned these drone strikes on places where we knew children were and then just go out for a burger in a, you know, trendy part of town in Tel Aviv. Another reservist says he saw civilians fired upon and then buried with bulldozers so the dogs don't eat them. Another saw a Palestinian tied up in the middle of the night, shivering in cold, while an IDF soldier just peed on him. Another describes looting Palestinian homes, and now they cannot live with themselves. Many of them, in fact, don't. We have seen increasingly reports of IDF soldiers killing themselves, suicide rates sky high. This man in the Haaretz article says he thinks about suicide all the time, but he just doesn't do it because he promised his mother he wouldn't. So his mother is keeping a constant watchful eye on her son. Imagine this, because she knows what horror he had witnessed. The IDF does not formally recognize moral injury or have programs in place for it. How could they? They'd have to accept blame for what they'd sent these young people to do. They only began tracking suicides in 2024. Now, here's what one IDF mental health officer reservist said. It's pretty obvious that it's a socio-political statement being made here. After all, if we recognize that many soldiers are suffering from moral injuries, how does this fit with the cliche about the most moral army in the world? So instead, they choose a phrase that shifts responsibility to the soldier as if there's a problem with his identity rather than the actions that his leaders sent him to perform. So again, imagine this. Oh, you shot someone's hand off and they bled to death while going and waiting for food. It was someone's grandma. And you can't take that. You can't just go back off to your life, have some kids and have a happy life. That's on you, right? No, obviously it offends human consciousness. There's a reason they're responding in a horrified way because they are still human. So I ask you, what does it mean to call an army moral if carrying out its orders is leaving its own soldiers psychologically and morally broken? The Zionist publication, The Free Press, says it's not really Israel that it's immoral. It's just an extremist problem. Clearly, it's not. If you read about these soldiers who committed these atrocities, they were not extremists. They were following orders and they were hyped up on the rage and revenge pumped into their blood by the IDF. And yet, no matter how many reports we have of these truly appalling behaviors and incidents from the IDF, bombing schools, children, defacing Christian artifacts, you name it, the Trump administration still goes out of its way to excuse Israel. Over the weekend, he posted this: whether you like Israel or not, they're great, they're loyal, they're bold, they're courageous, they're smart. They're the best ever, Clayton. It's the best ever, basically.
Yeah.
And a few days later, he posted this: no, Israel didn't make me bomb Iran. I've always wanted this. It was, I'm the boss of me, basically. And then this morning, he has this moral ranking. He posted this, claiming that eight women are sentenced to be executed by hanging in Iran. Now, only one of them is verified to have a court case against her. She was detained alongside her husband for using explosives against the Iranian government and police during the protests in January. The other seven may or may not be true. I was not able to verify them. If you have something to send me, I'd love to see it. But they also, this also seems to be an excuse of whataboutism for Israel. Like, yes, we know this. They're defacing Christian artifacts. They're blowing up churches. They attack civilians. They double tap. They go after medics. But Iran's doing this. So this is where we're, this is what we care about, this and this only. They're doing the bad stuff. We're going to stop it. Now, I'm not defending Iran. And if these women's cases are real and they, in fact, are innocent, that deserves scrutiny and outrage 100%. But we do know about atrocities from Israel that are ignored by the American government. We do know about the total annihilation of Gaza and the invasion of Lebanon. Now, Israel has said, okay, we apologize. We replaced that sledgehammered Jesus with this one. Can't sledgehammer this one. It's made of metal. And we're investigating this. But they also have this pattern of claiming to investigate when they are caught. For instance, they originally denied killing 10 medics in Gaza. But when the video footage showed that they did, in fact, stalk them and execute them, they admitted to it and said, okay, we'll investigate. So to the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government, you don't get to invent or inflate atrocities abroad and then distract from the ones that we already know and can verify and document. Moral army is not a slogan. Moral injury is the result of this. And yet the standard is collapsing under the weight of its own evidence. So let us know what you think of this morality.
A lot of people in the chat room are saying, and I watched videos of Bumblebee said, I watched a video of an IDF soldier shooting a woman in the head while holding her baby.
Oh my gosh.
Others saying like, well, yeah, they even take photos of them with children's toys after they've killed the children, and that's verifiable. So showing, there's plenty of evidence on this. Like Joy's, where is the evidence? For sure. I mean, you can see there's just an overwhelming number of evidence now as well. So you just have to go looking for it. It's being censored, of course, but if you want to educate yourself on it, it's all out there.
Well, again, listen to the IDF soldiers' own words about what they did and saw. They said, you know, we would bulldoze these neighborhoods and go into these Palestinian homes, and we just take what's there. And one of them's like, I didn't really want to do that. We're stealing from these people. And my colleague, my fellow soldier, was like, their story's over. They're never coming back here. Take what you want. Whatever it is you see, just take it. You know, their food, their possessions, their whatever. Condemn all we want, but this is their words. Go ahead, Philip.
Oh, well, two things. One, the soldiers involved in the destroying of the Jesus statue, they're currently under 30 days of military detention.
It looks like
the next thing I was going to bring up, Clayton's bringing up right now, the soldier cooking in Lebanon.
Yeah, here's an IDF soldier shared photos of himself cooking in a house occupied by the Israeli army in southern Lebanon. So they're just like, they went to the garden and basically just took the food and were just cooking using stuff from their own yard and like basically camped out in this house. And, you know, that's what they do. So
they said so. This is not me condemning, you know, making this up. Read it. Haaretz is an Israeli newspaper. And these IDF soldiers, obviously, you know, they're still human left inside of them because they're suffering after what they did. I wonder if the chat room has any kind of they don't feel sorry for them.
No, there's a lot of people in the chat room are like, wait a minute. So they're killing children and murdering people and then they're committing suicide. Bah, wah. Sorry. Like, I'm not upset about it. Like, okay. Like, they just killed. Like, I saw someone in the chat room saying, well, you're actually helping. Like, you know, these soldiers killing themselves after they've killed children and they committed these, you know, this heinous acts. And they're like, you're actually helping things by taking themselves out. That's what the chat room is saying.
I mean, it's hard to... I think it would be human of us to reach out and feel some empathy, right?
I have no empathy for.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to think. What would a good person do?
The only way I can find empathy is knowing that a lot of these are kids, you know, 19,
yeah,
20,
they're young
years old that are coming being propagandized their entire life to believe those people are subhuman.
They're radicalized at a child, at a young age, joining the IDF, and they have to be a part of it. Yeah,
right.
I'm always a glass half full kind of person, and I have empathy. You know, trying to have empathy. I just think it's not for us to really decide on that. It's, you know, it's like their makers' decisions and how they're going to be processed in the afterlife or whatever.
But what I don't feel is vengeful. Like, good, I don't feel that. I wish it would just stop. They're a product of, like David said, a horrible environment. We have American soldiers who did horrific things to Iraqis coming home with this kind of moral injury. And, you know, it, I think it should be within
Vietnam,
us.
Vietnam, like the Malaya massacre. I mean, I just, you know, look at, you know, look at the reporting on that and look at the soldiers that, of course, dealt with that for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
You know, slaughtering people. But someone in the chat room made a good point. Like, there's no such thing as a moral army. And that's a good point. Like, if your whole job, if you're like trained to kill, like, is there such thing as a moral army? Like, you know, that's a good question.
Well, my argument has always been you don't spread peace with bombs and guns.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, this we're getting into philosophy, which I don't feel equipped to lead a discussion. I'm just looking at it as a mom, and this guy who said my mom's watching me so I don't kill myself, she must know what her son has done to other people. She knows how it's torturing him. This is a generational trauma that will only perpetuate itself, and it's terrible. They're not the ones who started this, right? They're a victim of it too in some way. And so
Seven Rank Species, how can you have empathy with the Nazi Zionists?
I'm just asking if we should. Is it the right thing for us to see them as victims of their environment?
Come on, Clayton, put yourself in those soldiers' positions fighting for your life. What the F, have empathy, you're horrible all the way around. Let's F and go. I don't understand. So put yourself in those soldiers' positions fighting for your life.
They were not sent into Gaza to fight for their life. They were sent into Gaza to destroy life.
Yeah, I mean, so, what are you talking about? I mean,
and then, yes, they were made targets.
Well, here are the IDF soldiers that I have empathy for. The IDF, the young IDF women soldiers, the young girls fresh out of the academy or whatever that were put on the front lines in those little outposts along the border. And they knew, and Bibi and those guys knew it was coming, and they allowed those IDF soldiers to be slaughtered. Some of them young girls, like 20, I don't even know what their ages were, but the young girls, young IDF soldiers who were put out there as cannon fodder when they stood down on purpose and allowed those IDF soldiers to be killed as part of this grand plan to then go in for the Greater Israel Project and destroy and kill tens of thousands of civilians inside of Gaza. So I do have empathy for them. But sending in IDF soldiers to commit atrocities and kill civilians and shoot little babies in the head, it's hard for me to have empathy for those types of people. Well, shooting through the windows of the hospital. We showed those videos 2 years ago on the show. Literally have surgeons trying to save people's lives while they're in the hallway. We have the video. And they're being sniped by IDF soldiers shooting surgeons in the head as they're trying to save lives. And they're just collapsing in a pool of blood in the middle of the hallway. Yeah. Like, I don't have a lot of empathy for those demons. I'm just sorry.
Yeah, and I always think to myself, like, if I were propagandized that much, could I actually ever kill a baby? Like, could I do that? Like, you have to be on a different level to do that. Like,
yeah, that's a good
point. I think that's beyond propaganda.
No, it's radicalization from childhood. That's here's a couple of super David. Chats. We'll do more of your super chats here in a moment, actually. We'll do that in a moment. Yeah. So get in your super chats, any questions you have here, any rumble rants, and we'll get there. But first, I want to tell you about our friends at American Financing. Let's be honest, the cost of living isn't just high, it's exhausting. I saw a post yesterday of In-N-Out Burger from 10 years ago, and it was a sign from In-N-Out Burger in 2016. And In-N-Out Burger price was like $3. It's gone up 71%. Same burger, probably less of a burger now, but in 10 years, it's gone up 71%. So if you've been leaning on credit cards just to like make ends meet, covering basics like groceries, gas, utility bills, you're essentially paying a survival tax of 20% interest or more right now. Our friends at American Financing have a better way. They're helping homeowners tap into the home equity because many Americans are sitting on a huge batch of home equity, especially if you bought your house before the year 2020. You could reposition some of that money and pay off high interest debt using American Financing. You can save up to $800 a month. That's nearly $10,000 a year back in your pocket. It's not a loan. It's not just a loan. It's a total financial reset. It takes just 10 minutes to find out what you could save. There are no upfront fees, no obligation to talk to a salary-based mortgage consultant. And here's the kicker. You start today, you could even delay two mortgage payments. American Financing Home Loans, 866-890-8434. That's 866-890-8434 today. And we just went through this ourselves here in our own house. Visit AmericanFinancing.net/redacted. A lot of people sitting on equity. And I would say you cannot eat equity, but you could reposition that equity into useful savings and pay off some of that high interest debt. Okay. Woodsy says, I'm a Canadian combat veteran of the Afghan war, and moral injury is a tough one.
I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for that experience.
Chili Pepper says, you know, the U.S. pays for all IDF mental and physical disabilities for life while our vets are homeless. Yeah. And by the way, Trump's new budget, $1.5 trillion, just the VA is just a small piece of that, mm-hmm. of course.
Yeah. And we covered how we're paying like pensions and stuff in Ukraine. We're paying for Israel. Like they get the free medical, you know, and everything. And we got so many people suffering over here, and we'd spend what, $1 trillion on war and can't spend a dime to help anyone here.
Yeah.
You want this one?
Sure. Moral armies don't leave their country's borders. Right.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Like you defend your homeland. That's a moral army.
I like that.
Yeah. Unless your morals are forced. Well, that's forced morals. We're forcing the moral of democracy.
Right. Yeah. Last time I felt as betrayed as I have by Trump was when Hulk Hogan joined the NWO. That one's lost on me.
The New World Order. Yeah. And he started wearing the black shirt and he had like the black beard and like he became one of the bad. He turned heel. Okay. And became a bad guy. And then
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that those things broke your heart. I share with you the first, not the second.
But that is good. That's really pretty funny. Trump just extended the ceasefire, no end date.
Oh, that's a good point. Hadn't noticed that. Like, it's just for now. They're just regrouping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good point. Because every time we've had this countdown, 5 days, 4 days, you know, and like, we're going to start bombing again. The markets go crazy. Now he's just like, eh.
Yeah.
We're just kind of leaving it open-ended right now. Chili, we're working on this story, actually. You should do a story of how Iran took out secret centers for cloud seeding, cloud pulling, fog, and radars in the UAE. Weather changed within a week. Now, there was a lot of rain that happened in Iran back in February prior to this. So, but yes, we covered here on the show, of course, a couple of weeks ago about how for years we have been carrying out weather manipulation over Iran, basically creating a massive drought. So that they were actually thinking about moving the capital of Iran, Tehran, to another area because it's become so drought-induced. But yeah, now rain falling. Imagine that. Suddenly we take out all these sites,
yeah.
And they're able to... But a lot of these HAARP arrays aren't stationed there. I mean, these HAARP arrays are in Alaska, Antarctica, and certainly Iran hasn't targeted any of those. So yeah, it'd be interesting to have a HAARP expert on the show to talk about that. I think... David, you said you were working on that already, so
yeah,
we'll figure that out.
I started working on that 2 days ago, and I saw that on X.
Cool.
Good. All right. Well, any other questions here? Love the show, of course, but the music is too cheesy. Okay, thank you for that.
Rude.
Well, we like, you know, we're just doing some this music, someone says in the chat. Oh. We just had some nice little country music here. What would you guys recommend? You guys want some hardcore death metal? Do you want some lo-fi beats?
Yeah,
you want some
lo-fi
beats? I can make the worst DJ mix ever and just put one of every genre in it, and you can just everybody can be unhappy.
Yeah. You're always going to make somebody unhappy. Hey, I want to mention that you should subscribe to our show. It's free. Thank you for being a subscriber. Turn on that little bell notification, too, so you'll be notified when we go live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Please do that. And also share the show with the loved ones out there, because we are being actively suppressed by these big tech platforms, specifically YouTube. So please, if you would comment, share, like, subscribe, that really helps the show and us to be able to get this information out to you. We don't have an agenda here, only the truth, covering the stories that the mainstream media ignores and that the politicians don't want you to know about. You know, what's the real story behind the story? That's our goal here at Redacted. So thank you guys so much for subscribing. Sign up for our newsletter as well at redacted.inc. And we'll see you back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Have a great night, everyone.